Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Karl Herup about his new book, How Not to Study a Disease, The Story of Alzheimer's. An authority on Alzheimer's disease offers a history of past failures and a roadmap that points us in a new direction on our journey to a cure. For decades, some of our best and brightest medical scientists have dedicated themselves to finding a cure for Alzheimer's disease. What happened? Where is the cure? The biggest breakthroughs occurred 25 years ago, with little progress since. In How Not to Study a Disease, neurobiologist Karl Herup explains why the Alzheimer's discoveries of the 1990s didn't bear fruit and maps a direction for future research. Well, Karl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So as we are living through the unprecedented times of the global pandemic, I was wondering if you could start by telling us how has it influenced you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience.
The pandemic certainly has been a major disruptor at just about every level. So obviously at the bench level, at the experimental level, we had to wind down a lot of what we were doing and put it on complete pause for many months. We're back up again, but not even still at full capacity. And intellectually, it was also a tremendous problem because all of the the in-person meetings that we would have, either seminars of visiting scholars or attendance at national and international meetings, all of that was completely put on hold. And virtual meetings are fine. They certainly have their place and they're better than nothing. But I would say it's been a difficult time at best.
And has it affected your travel? And do you think you will limit your travel further?
Oh, completely. The only meeting I've gone to, and I still look back and regret it, was I went to the International Alzheimer meeting in July in Denver. I don't regret the meeting itself. It was wonderful and very exciting, but I think it was a little bit reckless on my part to mingle with hundreds, if not thousands, of other international travelers. So, yes, and I have no plans for any meetings for the foreseeable future.
So can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Well, I guess I would characterize myself as a basic scientist, interested in the biological basis of human disease. At a scholarly level, my interest is in the process of neurodegeneration. And I've studied diseases from rare ones like ataxia telangiectasia that affects young children, to the one where I've, I think, spent most of the time on my career, and that is studying Alzheimer's disease and other late onset dementias. I have applied this craft literally all over the world, and think of myself as having a somewhat international outlook on science, and very much value the international complexion of science and how that strengthens the entire enterprise.
And how did you get interested in sciences?
Well, if you really want to know, I think I could trace that back to a course in genetics that I had the second year of college. I often attribute that course to planting the bug in my brain that has stayed there ever since. It was a great disappointment to my parents that I was diverted from going to medical school and ended up doing something worthless like becoming a PhD instead of an MD. It seemed to have made out all right.
And along your career journey, were there any mentors that you find really supportive?
Oh, absolutely. And they come in at all ages and all flavors. I like to say some of my best mentors have been students, where I feel that in struggling to teach them in ways that can reach them, I actually learn a lot more of my own craft and my own and improve my own knowledge. But certainly that the professor from that genetics course at Brandeis University, Chandler Fulton, would be one of my mentors. I'd give great stock to my graduate advisor, Eric Schuter, and postdoctoral advisors, Dick Mullen and Hans Ternan. And along the way, just countless people have influenced me and both guided my thinking and sharpened my thinking.
And what would you tell our younger listeners who might be considering career in research instead of medicine?
I would say I have found it to be a wonderful life, but you have to live your life, not me. And I think you need to decide for your own. It's not an easy path, but I don't think any path in life is easy. I have found it to be one of the greatest jobs in the world, and wouldn't trade it for anything. But it's a very individual decision. I just would encourage younger people to, no matter what path they choose, to always stay curious and keep asking questions. Even if you go into a more directed field like medicine or find yourself rather than an academic industry, academic pursuits, find yourself in industry or an area of science is perhaps more applied. Stay curious, always ask questions. And even in medicine, even in industry, you'll do better at what you do for nurturing that curiosity.
Oh, these are excellent points. Thank you for that. So your latest book is How Not to Study a Disease, The Story of Alzheimer's. Can you tell us how did you come to writing it?
I can, and it actually follows nicely from the comments I just made about curiosity. I guess I have I find it difficult to just unquestioningly accept the dogma of a field. And I came to Alzheimer's research sort of in the middle of my career. So I think I said in the beginning, my interest had been in cell death, and I had been focused mostly on childhood diseases, but clearly with a major neurodegenerative phenotype, such as you find in Alzheimer's disease, it wasn't going to be long before it captured my attention, and it did. So I made the move to the Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland and joined the Alzheimer's Research Lab there. And it very quickly became apparent to me, coming to it as a now sort of mid-career scientist already, that a lot of what was purported to be settled art or settled dogma in the field just didn't make sense. And from those very early concerns grew a nagging doubt that we were approaching this disease in the best way possible, or even a sensible way. So I like to say this book sort of had a very long gestation period. It literally began when I was in Cleveland, which was in the early 2000s. And then finally, and I describe these events in the book with the event that I call the third inflation. I had simply had it. I just couldn't not speak up. And that led to a series of articles that I wrote in the professional literature. But I remained frustrated and felt that I needed to reach out not just to my colleagues, who were probably tired of hearing from me, but to a broader audience, and to try and explain where my frustration was coming from and why I thought that the story of Alzheimer's actually applied in an industry-wide fashion and had lessons beyond the study of Alzheimer's itself.
So let's delve into some of the science and the stories that you tell in your book, and let's start from the very basics. Could you describe what is an Alzheimer's disease?
Ah, well, you've really hit the most difficult question for your first one. So let me just say, I would define Alzheimer's disease by its clinical symptoms. So it is a progressive dementia that is characterized by a series of peculiar symptoms that a trained neurologist would be able to recognize. The most famous of these, of course, is the gradual loss of the ability to form and retain short-term memories. But there are, in addition, behavioral manifestations. So aggression, apathy, depression, all symptoms of the progress of the disease. And finally, it appears that almost no region of the brain is spared. And at the end stages of the disease, an individual is institutionalized almost always. They're unable to care even for their most basic needs. And are very susceptible to all sorts of opportunistic infections. And of course, one of the great tragedies, which I mention in the book, is that it's an extraordinarily long disease. It takes over a decade from first diagnosis to death. And the burden borne by both the person with the disease and also their family and caregivers is enormous.
And what is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia?
Officially, dementia is the broader class of late onset degenerative brain disease. But as it's currently defined, Alzheimer's is by far the major type of dementia. So Alzheimer's is a dementia, but it is only one of several types.
And that's something that really strikes me when I was reading in your book, that quite often, more often than not, if the person recognizes that they are losing their memory, they're likely to have other dementia rather than Alzheimer's. And with Alzheimer's, person is quite often unaware.
Yes, it is a very strange but persistent symptom of the disease that the person is unaware of what's happening to them. Or at the very least, they can't articulate their awareness. But the change in the person is quite apparent to their family and to their friends.
So now if we talk a little bit about the perception of Alzheimer's disease from all of these different points of view. So for example, from physicians, from researchers like you, and also from patients and their families.
My hope would be that in the long run, those three views would be a unitary view, that they would be united. That we would leave the situation we find ourselves in now, where what the patients care about is different than what the physicians describe as the disease, and that both the physicians and layperson's description would be couched in terms that basic researchers such as myself could go into the laboratory and actually begin to do productive work that would either arrest the disease and prevent it from progressing, or prevent it from starting in any significant way.
So why are there such gaps between all these sort of entities, if I can put it this way? So why, for example, patients perceive the disease in a way different, in a different way from basic researchers who might be looking at the very specific points they want to intervene with?
Well, I think the biggest problem we face is that in attempting to create a biological definition of the disease, we've messed up and created something that is not only inaccurate, but really inhibitory to any sort of productive research. So with a patient and their families, obviously they don't, they're not scientists and they're not trained in medicine. What matters to them is what is happening to the family, what is happening to the loved one with the disease, what is happening to the people who have to care for them. Those symptoms are what we would call clinical symptoms. You know, how much can they remember? How careful do we have to be that they're not wandering? And so on and so on. For physicians and scientists, though, that those list of symptoms don't represent a roadmap to treatment. We need to understand what is the biology. And here is where we got caught, because the disease, beginning with its naming by Alzheimer and Kraepelin back in the early 1900s, almost irretrievably linked the appearance of these funny deposits in the brain as causative elements in the disease. And it was a noble and even laudable hypothesis 100 years ago. But we've collected a lot of data in the interim, and the data is simply inconsistent with that hypothesis. We need to abandon it, but for reasons that I explore in the book, and honestly to this day don't fully understand, the field has been unwilling to give up on the on that linkage between pathology and behavior, and we've ended up in a mess.
So what are the leading hypotheses that we have for what causes Alzheimer's?
So the leading hypothesis is known as the amyloid cascade hypothesis, and this is a the prediction that a series of events beginning with the deposition of this small peptide known as beta amyloid is the trigger for a cascade of events that ultimately leads in the dementia that we find as Alzheimer's disease. And that idea has dominated the field and really squeezed out all other perfectly viable hypotheses that then become discouraged and not tested. So these other hypotheses include oxidative damage. They include the loss of genomic integrity through DNA damage in the neurons and other cells of the brain. It includes pathological deposits of tau, which are also part of the picture of the Alzheimer brain. It includes loss of myelin. It includes mitochondrial dysfunction. It includes the impact of a cellular state known as senescence. It includes the many, many, many alternatives exist. They aren't mutually exclusive, and yet somehow it's become the sort of the requirement of the field that you must relate whatever your hypothesis is, you have to explain it in terms of beta amyloid. And this is simply nonsense.
Do you think this is one of the major hindrances to our ability to find a cure for it?
I absolutely do. Yes, unequivocally.
So how is studying Alzheimer's disease approached nowadays?
It's approached as we approach any disease. You start with a hypothesis. You perform an experiment based on that hypothesis. You analyze your data, and then you adjust your hypothesis and start the process over again. And where we're stuck is that we formed a hypothesis, we did the experiments, we analyzed the data, they don't agree with our hypothesis, and we don't change the hypothesis. So it's kind of like beating your head against a wall. It only feels good when you stop.
So why do you think this hypothesis, the amyloid cascade, is so resilient to being changed?
That's a really interesting question, and I wish I could answer it for you, but I can't. I try and explain, and in the book, I try and go into what I think was the psychology of the different epochs in which Alzheimer's research emerged. I track some strategic decisions that I describe as more political in nature than scientific. They all seemed smart at the time, but looking back, their impact has been to really distort our field in a way that just precludes us from making progress. And in many ways, I need to apologize because I wish I had an answer. I'm as frustrated, probably more frustrated than anyone, that I can't give a clear alternative path to a cure for this horrible disease. Mostly what I'm trying to do by this book and in my other writings and teachings is just to get people to reset, to go back and as I put it, start listening to our own data. And hopefully from there, get to where we need to go. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, not at all. That's exactly the point, to really shake up the field, to get people thinking about all of these alternatives and where can we put our brain power to explore.
Exactly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what you think is the significance and perhaps potential of the biotech and maybe pharma industries in our quest of finding a cure?
I think they're really important. And I say in the book that I admit when I started, I was looking to, you know, try to paint the pharmaceutical industry as one of the major villains of the story. But the facts just simply don't bear that out. And what I came to not just realize, but appreciate in writing the book and in getting the data together for it. We really, really, really need the pharmaceutical industry if we're ever going to have any chance of combating this disease. Basic researchers like myself, we solve a problem, we just want to move on. But solving a problem intellectually doesn't get a pill or a treatment into anybody's clinic. And it's that gap that's filled by the pharmaceutical industries, and they're extraordinarily efficient at it. And I have recently begun to highlight the immense success of the viral vaccines we've been able to develop. Yes, that was built on a solid foundation of basic science, but boy, it just would not have happened without the biotech industry and even some of the, and including the major pharmaceutical houses, putting their shoulder to the wheel and making vaccines happen. And yet they too bear a certain responsibility for our being stuck. A variety of reasons having to do with ego, having to do with, I think, financial incentives that are divorced from scientific judgment. The field has been a party to the dominance of the amyloid model of Alzheimer's disease. And as I say in the book, that's not really responsible behavior. They have the data. They know how good it is. They have some of the best statisticians in the world. And rather than use them to truly guide the financial risk that they take, they use them to paper over, in retrospect, what have been bad risks. And that's sad.
So I'm sure many of our listeners heard the news over summer about Alzheimer's drug aducanumab being approved by FDA. So could you tell us a little bit about it and what is your perspective?
Well, I'm sure it'll come as no surprise to you or to anyone who's listened this far. I think that decision was a disastrous one. And it has been playing out in much the way that we expected. the statistics were reworked in the most aggressive way possible to find a shadow of a possibility. And on the basis of that, the FDA made what I think was a almost irresponsible decision to go ahead and approve the drug. And the outcry in the field has been very substantial. And I find it coming from not just people like myself who don't feel that amyloid reduction of amyloid is going to do anything for the disease, which is certainly part of the criticism. But I think even people for whom amyloid is remains their top model, the process by which the drug was approved still comes up for criticism. So, and it's playing out, as I said, as one might have predicted, the drug is not being adopted. The European regulators have now said they're not going to prescribe it. The Japanese have said they're not going to prescribe it. There's still debate in the United States. After the FDA approved, our public healthcare system, what passes for public healthcare system, Medicare, has not decided whether or not they're going to approve it. And there's a lot of pressure on them to not approve it, in part because it is not efficacious, or at least not very efficacious. I would say not efficacious. In part because there are clear risks involved, attributable to brain swelling, and both short and long-term consequences of that. And just at a very basic level, the cost is so exorbitant that, and the number of people with the disease, the number of potential people who would use the drug is so enormous, that it would quickly bankrupt our entire healthcare system.
And what do you think the ramifications would be for other companies seeking the FDA approval for their antibodies that might be clearing amyloid? Do you think they might be driving price down?
Well, yes, I think they're definitely driving price down. In fact, I haven't followed through, but I did see a headline a day or two ago that Biogen had taken the step of reducing the cost of what they call Aduhelm by half. I think the hot breath of competition certainly is part of that. But I think part of it is that they have not convinced the medical community that this is a drug worth prescribing. As a basic researcher, what I worry about is that now, if reduction of a biomarker, and I would argue an unproven biomarker, is now sufficient to get emergency approval from the FDA, well, there is a long line of companies and a long line of products that's going to be forming at the FDA's door saying, well, look, we reduced tau. You should improve our drug. Hello, we also reduced amyloid using a different method. You should approve our drug. And pretty soon we'll have all these drugs that don't do anything out on the market. And I think the risk is substantial that the public and the governments of the world will begin to lose confidence and lose faith in the biomedical establishment.
Oh, that's such a key point to really bring across to people, that even when the amyloid itself, so from biomolecular perspective, is being cleared out, it might not translate into clinical benefits. So even from the basic science, we cannot just go straight to clinical benefits in humans.
Correct. Yeah.
And now thinking about more of a top-down approach of regulation and also studying Alzheimer's, really. So what are the roles of universities or governments in how this research is being subsidized, for example?
Yeah, good question. I've thought about it a lot, and I think it, this is an area where we could, you know, debate and productively for quite a while. My personal opinion is that most of modern medical advance has been built on the shoulders of strong basic research. So now, of course, I have skin in this game. I'm far from a neutral observer on this, but I do believe that the governments of the world would be well advised to put substantial effort into the funding of basic research. And I emphasize basic rather than applied, because, as I like to say, you just don't know where your next good idea is going to come from. And, you know, we are now having a revolution in gene editing based on an absolutely arcane set of enzymes in a bunch of weird bacteria that no one had ever heard of. Mm. But that's the whole basis of CRISPR-Cas9. If you tried 20 years ago, or let's say 30 years ago, to make a funding decision based on whether or not you should fund research into these odd creatures, I think all of us, including myself, would have said, well, no, I don't think so. But look what happened. So there's that. I do think then there is a role this is where I would put sort of I think that would be the cornerstone of the university and research institute work. But building on that cornerstone, there is a role for basic translational work. That is to say, at the end of the day, the bacteria are really fun, but you've got to begin to connect that to mammalian physiology, and in particular to human physiology. And because there is a basic research gap between the odd creatures of the world and, you know, the human biology. And that's where clinical medicine is going to achieve its most benefits. So I would extend that all the way through the initial stages of clinical trials. So whether a drug based on a new discovery is safe, phase one clinical trial, or shows early signs of being effective, phase two clinical trials. I think there's a role for government, and I think even university tech transfer groups have a role there. But I would put a very hard stop right there. And then I believe that the more expensive, clinically intense phase three trials, those are expenses that need to be borne by industry itself. And I think that would make for a much more productive biotech industry and biotech machinery.
So now, thinking about the bigger picture, in what ways our thinking and understanding Alzheimer's is being shaped by the political, economic, and also social forces of the day?
Oh, I would, tough question. I mean, everything is of course influenced by the politics of the day and the social questions of the day. I think the problem with Alzheimer's disease is that in trying to move quickly, we've moved rashly, rather than sort of accept our own lack of knowledge I would call it almost a humility. You know, rather than being humble in the face of our lack of knowledge about the disease, we've instead become arrogant and said, oh, no, I know exactly what's going on. We just have to do this. And if it doesn't work, it means we just need to select a slightly different group of patients, or maybe we need to go a little bit earlier in the disease. So that attitude is, I would characterize it as political and social. It has, sadly, not a lot of scientific merit to it.
And what are the implications of raising these issues for the wider society, especially in terms of more aging population and people living much longer, about the burden of the disease?
Yeah, it's critical. And here again, I sure wish that I had an answer, you know, a recipe for success. I don't. I devoted a whole chapter in the book to what we know, well, sort of a introduction to what we know about the biology of aging, because Alzheimer's is sort of a poster child for the fact that the successes in public health that have extended human lifespan to well beyond what it was back when we were in prehistoric times, that success has led to the paradox of exposing us to diseases that our 10,000-year-old ancestors would never have known about because they never got old enough to get them. So we need, and it's why I make such a big push in the book to redouble and more our efforts to understand the biology of aging, because whatever that turns out to be, it's the key to not just Alzheimer's disease, but a host of diseases that afflict all of our body systems, from our hearts to our joints to our bones to our muscles, our kidneys, our livers. It affects all of us. And I raise the question in the book about whether we'll stop aging. I don't think we will. What all we can do, I believe, is to keep what's called our health span as long as possible. So in understanding the biology, you can keep our muscles as healthy as they can be for as long as possible, keep our brains as healthy as they can be for as long as possible. But, you know, it's sad, but death is not optional.
This is such a great point, and actually it brings me back to the beginning of your book when you were telling a story of one of the Alzheimer's patients, and something that you wrote about them is that they've done everything in quotes right with regards to exercise and the diet, and still ended up with this disease. So I wonder, to what extent should we be thinking about preventative measures, but maybe not putting all of our eggs in one basket?
I would definitely agree with that point of view. Prevention, lifestyle choices. I mean, it's really boring. And from a biotech point of view, from a pharmaceutical point of view, it's not only boring, it's unprofitable because there's no intellectual property involved. But, you know, no one's going to make a whole lot of money prescribing a daily walk. And yet it makes perfect sense from a more holistic view of aging and of diseases like Alzheimer's. And I mentioned keeping blood pressure under control. Same thing. There's some pills to be sold there, but not a lot of intellectual property left. And so not, you know, you'll never be able to charge $56,000 for a one-year treatment of keeping blood pressure down. So I guess if you take a step back, what I'm really arguing is that our pharmaceutical models need to change.
So what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, How Not to Study a Disease, surprised you the most?
I guess the diversity of brain features that are lost in Alzheimer's disease. I mean, it just seems like every time I turn around and look at the cells of the brain's innate immune system, every time I look at the behavior of the oligodendrocytes that make myelin, every time I even just look at neurons in regions of the brain that are not supposed to be affected by Alzheimer's, I'm just astonished that the effect of this illness, and I say it hesitantly because I want to include aging in that in the list of causes, but the loss of function is extraordinarily widespread, and I think that in the end is the message that we're slowly coming around to realizing.
And you yourself, do you follow the Mediterranean diet?
Probably not as well as I should, but I do try and watch. I think all of us are human, and we, as a species, have a great deal of trouble with delayed gratification. And since the delay in this case can be 30, 40, 50 years, it takes a real iron will to be able to live perfectly. But as I think, as you pointed out just a moment ago, the story of Dorothy is a stark reminder that even if you were to do everything perfectly, it's still not a guarantee.
Yeah, I can allow a scoop of gelato now and then.
I would even recommend it.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Well, I don't plan to write another book, I have to say. It was a major effort, and I'm not sure I've got another book in me. My lab is interested in myelin and inflammation and DNA damage and in fact how those three things relate to each other. It's a complex web. I try and keep it reduced to specific experiments, but it's a challenge. And I'll be honest, I've been in this game long enough that I'm sort of going about ready to pass the torch to others to keep up the fight. Maybe if I can make a few early entrees into these fields, I can light the way for others to carry on.
Yeah, you're truly an inspiration to many of the younger scholars.
I hope so.
Where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, the book, you can just head to MIT Press when pick it up on their website. It's available on all the commercial booksellers online. And I just would be delighted to have you read it. And I'm also delighted to get feedback. Things that are easy to understand, hard to understand, and maybe there will be a second book in me one day.
Oh, let's hope so. Well, thank you so much for joining me today and for this refreshing discussion.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.